welcome everyone to another edition of, I think we're up on number 14. Well, I'm well into the double digits now, which is great. I am in the west of Ireland. I couldn't be any farther away from my next guest, Mike from Salted Stone. You're in Lake Tahoe. It's May, yet there's snow on the ground. Tell me what's going on.
Yeah, surprising. Surprising certainly to me as well. We decided to move up here. I'm from Southern California.
Yeah.
Which is where I've kind of spent my my life and where the majority of the Salted Stone team, at least the North America team, is located, right outside of Pasadena. About a week and a half ago, I guess technically a week ago, actually today, relocated the family up to Lake Tahoe. So we're in Incline Village, Nevada, which is northeast Lake Tahoe. And we packed, we're in an Airbnb for a couple of weeks before we move into the place we're going to be living. And we have bathing suits, and we got up here and
ready.
So
now you're studying Wim Hofman, the breathing technique, and you're doing the cold bath.
Yeah, exactly.
It's turned around. It's very interesting. What brought on the move, Mike? What was the kind of behind that?
I'm constantly bringing ideas to my wife, and she's constantly saying no to all of my ideas. So if I bring her 100 ideas and she says no to 99 of them, the one that she doesn't say no to is the one we wind up moving forward with. And in a very kind of short, succinct way, that's what happened with Lake Tahoe.
She said yes, and before she knew it, she woke up the next morning, she was in Lake Tahoe.
She didn't say yes. She didn't say yes. She just didn't say no. And she didn't say no every step of the way, all the pieces that needed to kind of fall in place in order to facilitate the move. She simply didn't say no to any of them. And so here we are. Normally she just says no. And then my ideas are kiboshed.
Yeah. This is a very interesting agency owner technique on actually that, you know, as I work with a lot of couples, I've never heard that one before. The process of not saying no. I'm loving it. It's really good. Well,
and that was it. That's ultimately how I kind of sold her on the idea. Because at first she said, She's kind of posed her first objection, her first obstacle, which was around finding a school for the kids.
Right.
She didn't think that we'd be able to find a school that both of us kind of agreed on. And,
right.
And so once the first obstacle was known, I kind of understood, okay, well, if I can solve obstacle number one, then she'll present obstacle number two. But ultimately what we did was kind of started with the end in mind, started with the move to Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
And then reverse engineered out all of the steps that would need to take place in order for that move to happen. So we had to sell housing and all sorts of stuff, right? And just kind of told her, convinced her, made the argument, which she bought, that we don't need to commit to all of these steps at one time. We only need to commit to one step, the next step. Right. So we can commit to this first step.
Yes.
See how it feels. And then if it feels good, take the next step. And we don't need to.
Yeah. Brilliant.
So that's all we did. We just committed to one step at a time. And here we are 6 months from the time that the conversation first started, living in one of the most beautiful places.
Oh, it's stunning part of the world. Follow your dreams. Here we go. I'm loving this. This is the start of the conversation because, you know, I'm really passionate about what agency owners can have for their business. If you want to live in Lake Tahoe, you know, what you got to do is work on the process of breaking down obstacles for your wife. But it's that kind of business, right? So you're kind of living and breathing that right now, which is incredible. But the journey, Mike, you know, you shared with me some information before you got here. You'd been studying philosophy and theology 10 years ago, but one morning you woke up and instead of taking the path as you were to becoming a priest, something clicked and you went, no, I'm going to do this line of business. Tell us a little bit more about what happened at that time.
Well, I think there was, there's a fair distance that was traveled in between the decision to not become a priest and start an agency. There's a gap there that we could spend a lot of time talking about, but suffice to say, that at the emergence from that gap at the time where we decided to start an agency, it was, my one of my close friends from high school, he and I, we're sitting out on a balcony one night, probably 20, 22, 23, maybe years old, 23, 24, in that range. And he was talking to me about a fella that he knew. He had just gone out to dinner with an acquaintance that was making good money, basically arbitraging Google. So wow. This is, if you're familiar with AdWords, and I assume you are familiar with AdWords.
Yeah, I'm well familiar. When you mentioned that arbitrage, I could probably tell you the course he bought.
Exactly. Yeah, so it was kind of, you know, the pre-quality score era of AdWords, which dates me, right? But the pre-quality score era of AdWords, you could get away with a lot as far as buying traffic for pretty cheap. And and so anyways, and neither one of us had any discernible skill sets, but we were interested. And so I bought a book on HTML. I never learned how to build a website, but I learned enough about HTML that I could rip down the fella's website who was doing it successfully and modify it enough and then push it live on our own domain. And then we just started cranking out content. So as the content is king, certainly back then it certainly was. Cranked out content, ran AdSense ads down the side of the site. We'd buy traffic for 10 cents a click. We'd convert about 33% of the traffic using AdSense ads on the side. So we'd buy traffic like 10 cents a click. We'd sell it for 65, 70 cents a click. We were converting about a third of all the traffic that came through the site, primarily because our site was tremendously like unhelpful. So someone would go into Google and they type in, you know, whatever, geothermal heating systems, which was one of our top performers, right? So they type in geothermal heating systems because they want to learn about geothermal heating systems. We're running an ad in Google. They click on our ad, they arrive at our website, they learn nothing at all about geothermal heating systems, and they have to click on one of the ads on the side to go find an article that's hopefully going to be more helpful than ours was. So anyways, in that process, we learned a bit about digital. We learned how to learn about code, learned about AdWords, learned about AdSense. And when Google, then we woke up one day, we started to make a little bit of money. Google introduced the quality score, woke up one day, the entire business model was smashed into smithereens. But now we had marketable skill sets. And that was really the beginning of the agency was, okay, well, the arbitrage thing failed. But look, like we know how to do AdWords and we know a little bit about websites. Let's go sell that skill and see if we can't turn it into something. And then, you know, slowly but surely it turned into something.
Yeah, which sure turned into something, all right. That's for sure.
Well, relatively speaking, I guess we're probably, you know, within the HubSpot ecosystem, we're a moderately sized agency. But relative to the larger kind of agency ecosystem or just businesses, industry in general, we're a drop in the bucket, right? We're not even worth mentioning.
it depends. There's a lot of ways to look at that, but you're definitely worth mentioning for this podcast. That's for sure. In our wee world,
somebody besides my mother thinks that I'm important.
This is in this wee world. This is where we're at. You mentioned HubSpot. When did that journey kind of unfold for you as your arbitrage world got blown up and you started doing other things?
So we started the agency in 2008, and from 2008 to 2012, we did search engine optimization and built websites. Really, that's what we did, and we probably grew from a team of two of us, which is where we started, to, I'm going to put us at roughly 10, 12 people over that 4-year window. And then in 2012, and a lot of the work was project driven. So we had a pretty robust everything's relative, but a robust roster of clients, but most of them would come to us for a project, we'd finish the project, and then we wouldn't hear from them again for 6 months, a year, 2 years, maybe never, right? Yeah. But we had this legacy kind of client roster. In 2012, I downloaded, I think, in maybe an editorial calendar template from HubSpot's website or something.
I remember it.
Someone called me. Who was it? It'll come to me in a minute.
It'll come to you.
She's actually still at HubSpot. And she's Annalisa Spector. So she was, she was like the cold caller. Outbound. Yeah. So she got on the phone with me. But she wasn't the closer at that stage. So she kicked me over to Ryan Carrick, who we've been with ever since. But anyway, so 2012 is when we came on with HubSpot. And we were able to move pretty quickly once we onboarded with HubSpot, because we had this legacy roster of clients that we were able to come back into and sell a more residual, you know, kind of retainer-driven offering back into. Yeah. So I think from 2012 to 2016, that was really, I'd call it like our first phase, the kind of the early years of us onboarding with HubSpot, really kind of ramping up. We had a lot of tailwinds, a lot of traction at that stage. We made a couple of really good hires, some ex-HubSpotters who brought a lot of value into the organization. And it's been good ever since. So, we've not in 11 years now of being in business, we've never had a year where we didn't grow. And I know this because we recently had a leadership summit, but you know, our 11-year compound annual growth rate, is 42%, right? So growing by an average of 42% over 11 years, year over year. Headcount has increased significantly. And that's just, you know, that's just talking about the North America business. That doesn't account for any of the work that we've done now that we're in Australia as well. So anyways, HubSpot's been, probably the single most significant catalyst for growth in the history of our agency.
It's amazing, because I remember seeing you speak that, I thought you'd been with them a lot longer than that. So I think you did a presentation for one of the partner things. It was when Marissa Smith was doing a piece in it would have been around the time of Inbound. It was before the formal partner day. It was kind of just before that time. I'm thinking it was 2014, actually. So you wouldn't have been that long. You would have been only really just in the door, and you were... So I remember significantly seeing the name, seeing the branding, looking at you guys. You're very, very polished.
Yeah, well, the one upside, I guess there's, you know, who knows? There's several upsides at all. The variables are bigger than my mind is really capable of grasping at any given point in time. One of the factors that worked in our favor, having come from basically a web dev type environment, right? We were just busting out, cranking out websites. We found early on that the difference between being able to sell a website and not being able to sell the website in many cases was the quality of the creative, right? So we emphasized, prior to becoming HubSpot partners, we had emphasized hiring creative talent. A lot of, I think, web shops, especially smaller web shops, smaller outfits, we'll try and find team members who can maybe design okay and develop okay. So you kind of have these hybrid players that you can just hire one person who can build an entire website from design and dev, rather than having to hire two people, designer and a developer. But we kind of made that distinction early on and saw the value in hiring specialists in respective roles. So by the time we became a HubSpot partner, we were really the second wave. You had the first wave of partners, PR 2020s.
Yeah.
Kunos, right? The first wave of HubSpot partners. We were kind of that second wave, a part of the second wave.
Yeah.
And we came with a pedigree, you know, as amateurish as it was and still is in some regard, that was steeped in creative and steeped in brand. And so I think from the beginning, we've had that as a differentiator in our favor. Everybody has their own differentiation. We happen to have a polished brand.
I think it was recently I downloaded one of your Tiny Pulse collaborations or something like that.
We'll
talk about that in a sec, but I remember that. Do you remember when HubSpot used to give the partners the ebooks, you know, that would, and you would see everyone using them, and you could tell, you know, that some agencies just didn't have that design creative and they were using, and then it's just something I significantly remember. And I do come across agencies that you can just tell that difference, and maybe that's hiring an internal designer, maybe you're too small to do that, or maybe an agency just invests in putting a graphic designer and a high-end designer on retainer, going you know, just putting that finishing touch. It's a competitive world, and standing out. I think that's I clearly remember that very early on in the day, I just remember standing up. I remember your slides. I remember your brand, and I remember your t-shirt. And I just went, here we go. This is all polished. But then you'd only been in the door at HubSpot. You know, it's all relative. Do you know?
I think it points to the kind of the power of perspective and really kind of speaks to the way that human beings, by our nature, learn, right? We are sensory creatures, right? So the first thing we do is perceive with our senses. So when you see with your eyes something that is attractive, your senses pull that in, and then your brain starts to chew on it and you formulate concepts, right? And that's kind of a unique defining characteristic of humanity in general, is our ability to exercise conceptual thought. Well, until the robots do it. But right now we still have that kind of as a distinct advantage in our favor. But ultimately, you don't know whether someone is smart or capable or anything else until after you talk with them. But you know whether or not you want to talk to them based on what they look like.
Correct.
Right. And so that, I think, especially at the beginning, was something that served to differentiate us and was a competitive advantage for us, was the fact that we had a really talented creative team. And ultimately our creative director, who, has been with us, Jiminy Cricket, probably 8 or 9 years now. It's hard for me to keep track. He might not even remember, but he's been an instrumental part of our progression, such that, in 2018, when we kind of went through the merger with Australia, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit, we made sure to carve out an equity portion for him and kind of reward him for the diligence and the difference that he's made in the organization over the course of the years.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, that's covering. We definitely will, because the world, thank you for bringing it up. This is a lovely segue, Mike, and unrehearsed too, right? As you know, just so much talk. You know, once a week I'm getting a phone call. Can you talk to me about mergers? What should I be doing? I even did a little mini podcast to talk about a call that I had. Somebody was got a random sort of, we might buy you. And it distracted the agency because they weren't even thinking about it.
Yep.
But you yourself, you were obviously, something clicked with you that you went, did you meet Tony first? Or was it something different that you went, and why Australia? You know, talk to us about that journey.
Yeah. I'll kind of preface the whole thing by saying, and anyone who's heard me speak at any of the HubSpot events previously will know that this is the case, or at least that I believe that this is the case. And everybody on the Salted Stone team is probably sick of hearing me say these types of things at this stage. I'll preface all of it by saying, like, none of it was really intentional or deliberate. Everything that has happened in Salted Stone's history has been, could only really be described by anyone who actually discerns and got into the data and kind of looked at it as a happy accident. I'd love to take credit, but it would be foolish for me to do so. The long and the short of it is, one thing that I can say is that I explore every opportunity. So when HubSpot put together and made available the mergers and acquisition marketplace, which I don't know, goes back probably 6 years now or something, 5 years. And at the beginning, it got a lot of activity. It's really slowed down. I don't even know if it's available anymore.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. Yeah, I haven't heard anything on it recently.
So they
might be digging it up again.
They had put together this marketplace, which was really cool, really awesome resource. The brand manager, Tony, who was CEO of Brand Manager, which was an agency headquartered out of Sydney, Australia, location in Perth as well, alongside a location in the Philippines. They weren't the first group that we wound up speaking with, right? So I think Tony was probably the second or maybe third or fourth, actually. We had gotten further along with a couple of opportunities that came through that merger and acquisition marketplace prior to. So I guess at the end of the day, one thing that I have been focused on is growth and opportunities for growth. And so when an interesting opportunity would come through that marketplace, in many cases, I was just from talking with the people who submitted the inquiry, I was normally the first person to reach out and call. In the case of Tony, however, I wasn't. I think we were the third or the fourth. group that they had spoken with by the time we were able to get on organized time zone differences and everything else. But I think with them, and I'll try and not put words in Tony's mouth, but what made it easiest for them, and this is being this is what Tony told me, is, and he didn't tell me this until after kind of the merger successfully consummated, but they got off the phone. It was Tony and his senior director of operations, Andrew, and yeah. we had a, it was just the three of us jumped on a call. They got off the call and said, you know what, like, this is the one, just culturally, this is the one culturally, it feels right. Mm-hmm. And so I guess that's probably what I'll emphasize is that the situations, and we've even post the merger with Australia, we've explored additional opportunities as well. And we've gotten far along with some, less far with others. The difference between we haven't consummated anything in addition, obviously, at this stage. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, folks would hear about it. But the difference in how far we get in the process, I think at the end of the day, really ties back into cultural alignment.
Yeah.
The situations where even if like all the finances lock in and it seems like a, you know, good strategic fit, but you just can't really jive with the person on the other end of the phone call, right? Because we're still so much of the identity of the agencies, we're all small. So much of the identity of the agencies is inherited by the leadership. Right. Yeah. So the identity of the agency is really in many respects, the identity, there's something fundamentally, there's a direct correlation between the character of the agency and the identity of the leadership team, who's shaping it. And so it's almost like, you know, you can look at the agencies as almost like individual bodies, right? Like, like this collective group that is functioning as one unit or one person. And just like in real life, not everybody gets along. Just like in real life, you're naturally going to have affinities with some types of people over other types of people. I think in the merger environment, as long as the leadership teams are staying involved and it's not purely kind of an economic play, and I don't think by and large the HubSpot agency ecosystem is to a stage of maturity where that's really happening, where it's purely just economics and in dollars and cents. I think that culture matters a heck of a lot. And so both in the opportunity where we did bring it across the finish line with the brand manager in Australia and in opportunities that we've explored since, the ones that progressed the farthest are the ones where there's just great cultural synergy, because the dollars and the cents, that's always going to cause friction, right? As you're trying to think through equity splits and new positions, roles and responsibilities, like those are going to be hard conversations. And I feel like the only way you make it through them, almost like a marriage, right? The only way you really make it through, the only people who have been married for 50, 60, 70, 80 years, right, are people who were willing to tolerate the deficiencies and idiosyncrasies and friction points associated with their partner or spouse, right? Because there is no perfect person. So you're always going to have the deficiencies that you have to deal with. And so the cultural alignment, I think the value alignment is what enables that process to continue.
Yeah. It's that click, isn't it? It's that feeling of, I can get on with these people. I'm going to be able to work on this with them. And I think that's the big thing that agencies, if like what I've noticed as well with some of the mergers and the talks, it's if you are looking at a merger because you want to start coasting, or you see an exit, or you see a financial bonus, like you go, oh, I think now I can ask for more money because we'll be a bigger company and I don't have to work as hard. It's not that, you know,
no,
it is more hard work in a different way and you have to be open and you have to be ready to, if you're tired of the game, don't merge with another agency because there's a whole new other game that's going to open up. It's for people that love the game, love what they're doing, and are open to another version of that.
Yeah. And I think there's also, I've been approached regarding a merger from an agency where the owner was very candid about his desire to slow down. And he's just like, a part of the reason why he was attracted to Salt and Stone, he's like, look, you're relatively young and you have a lot of energy for this. And like, you seem like you're ready to plow ahead for the next 20 to 30 years. Like, I don't want to do that. I don't have the energy anymore. Yeah. I want to back off. I'm 60 years old and right. Like, you know, so, and I get it. Right. But now you have an equity partner who's effectively not a non-contributor, right. In a meaningful capacity. And, yeah. and that's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah.
And I also think about it, right. Like if I were to, let's just say I decided today, you know, I'm going to slow down. I'm going to back off. I got a good management team in place. The North America operation kind of just, it's on autopilot, cruise control. It can continue to run. I mean, that's kind of true, right? Like, that which simply wouldn't be fair to the partners that I took on in the merger, who expected me to focus on growth, who expected me not to go into autopilot and coast, but instead to take this thing from what it is, right, to something much more significant. Right. So I think if there's probably room for in the ecosystem for you know, an agency owner who's very clear and upfront about his or her intentions to slow down, to back off through a merger, to be able to do so. But it's going to take a unique set of circumstances, a unique landscape to find a partner who's willing to merge in that capacity, right? Because there's something about it that's just not very attractive.
Yeah, exactly. It just isn't. And maybe in the future, but not right now. You mentioned culture a lot. What would be, if you were to kind of bottle your secret sauce for culture, and you know how strong it is, and I can see how strong it is, and I've talked to many people in your organization, do you have a secret formula for culture?
I think I don't know exactly how to answer the question. What I will say, like, we have a culture code, and I think it's on our website on the about page, and if you were to take a look at that, I think it would communicate a lot about how we attempt to manage the people within the business. I guess there's probably two items from that culture code that stand out most distinct for me that I think kind of inform the rest of them. And those two are, we make every effort to treat the people on our team according to what we believe is kind of their intrinsic dignity. So we believe that human beings have a fundamental value that's kind of inalienable, right? It's intrinsic to their nature, and we try to treat people that way. And so if that's like 1A, then 1B, I would say, how does that tend to manifest itself most concretely? I think, and this is also kind of in the culture code, but we tend to focus on, rather than focusing on results or success or failure, we tend to focus on like disposition or attitude, like your attitude and your level of effort, right? If you have a good attitude, good is a pretty kind of umbrella term for a bunch of characteristics or attributes that would roll up into it, right? If you're humble, if you are a person who just kind of is naturally grateful for opportunities and recognizes kind of your own smallness in this cosmic soup, right? Like if you have a good attitude and you're a hard worker, and hard worker is also pretty relative, right? Like if you take me, there's three of us that started Salted Stone. I guess two of us started, but we took on a third partner pretty early on. If you were to line us all up in a row and say, okay, all three of you work your hardest, we're each going to get like different distances, right? So if you were to put a bag full of 100-pound bag of rocks on my shoulder and 100-pound bag of rocks on Nick's shoulder and 100-pound bag of rocks on Tony's shoulder and say, carry it as far as you can, we're all going to get a different distance out carrying that bag of rocks. So it's less focused on the distance that you can carry those rocks and more focused on like, hey, are you carrying it as far as you can?
Right.
If you're carrying it as far as you can, that's all that I care about.
That's right. Yep.
And so I think we manage the team from that perspective, not like, hey, he carried the rocks further than you did, but are you carrying them as far as you can? And as long as you're carrying them as far as you can, then all good. And I think that creates a culture that is like patient. It's respectful of the differences between people. It's respectful of every individual's unique strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
And it allows folks, I think, to flourish in an environment where they're not afraid. And by virtue of that, I mean, when you look at our team member churn, like yeah. it's, I mean, I would argue it's lower than it should be. Right.
right.
We have negative churn,
no.
over the past, you know, 6 to 7 years.
Yeah.
So I think the culture is, it's a strong culture.
Yeah, and I think you brought up a really good word there, which is the difference is I see a lot of culture washing going on right now. It's like, oh, culture, let's buy this, paint it over. We've done it. They call one team building event, it's culture. It's not. It's something much more intrinsic. And the code is something that is all a series. It's a whole step and a whole formula and a whole process around that. Really, really important to do that. There's actually some good HubSpot material as well, as I know you've got some great material on it that people can check out, which is really good.
I think we actually put out a piece with Tiny Pulse, like a culture code guide, like how to build a culture code, which could be a good resource for folks who are kind of exploring that themselves.
Yeah, which is brilliant because I think this is what agency owners have forgotten sometimes, because you went through all of that and you were using Tiny Pulse. You have now got an insight into that world, which is communication and which is can help people with their digital marketing. I was speaking to some of your team there and expanding on that. So you do the work yourself and then you never know where that's going to lead to. I think that's one of the biggest opportunities out there for agency owners. But with you at the moment, like Australia, that's been about a year in the, I remember, is that a year sort of cooking right now or formula?
A year as of July 1st.
That's right. Yeah. And so first you're in, and where to next? Where are you off to next?
It's really interesting. It's kind of a big, I think, transition period right now. So the one thing, everything that I've ever learned, I probably learned just by making mistakes. That's generally speaking.
You're not afraid.
Which explains my arrest records and everything else, right? So
That's another show.
But ultimately, I think. One thing when I reflect back on the past 12 months and think about things that I could have done better or things that I should have done better post-merger, opportunities for my own improvement, and this will segue nicely into kind of what comes next. The thing that I think I've failed to do adequately is, right, so we kind of have this North American agency that was all about North America. There was an Australian, or call it, you know, an APAC agency that was all about APAC. The two of them merged together, but there was never really any elevation from a focus, a resource perspective mm-hmm. to like a global level, right? So just kind of, it continued to be really two independent, autonomous entities that shared a brand. So there are walls that exist operationally. There are walls that exist culturally to some degree. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that I did a very good job from a leadership perspective at emphasizing the importance of breaking down those walls.
Right.
Because I think where we're going to see the exponential gains is when we're truly operating as a global entity rather than the regional entities.
The region is North America, a lot more advanced in the stage of things with the likes of Australia. Like, I onboarded Tony and Maria in their agency I was living in Dublin, because that was 2012, 2013, because HubSpot didn't even have an office open in Sydney. So, you know, like there is a big difference there when it comes to, you know, the regions, and the regions here in APAC are still kind of catching up. They're further ahead than what the Middle East would be, but then Europe is a little bit ahead of them. So but America, we feel, is, you know, definitely 2 years into their ecosystem ahead of everyone.
Hmm. Yeah. So it's been interesting because there's a difference in the marketplace as far as familiarity with digital, right?
Yeah.
Like what state? Yeah. Like there's still, you can still be an exclusively SEO agency in Australia and be, you know, printing money. And that's just like,
no problem.
That for 10 years in here in the US, was that, you know, 10 years ago.
Gone. Still- yeah. Even people are dropping the inbound word, you know, like you look at Mike and the guy just got, you know, the guys at Square 2 have dropped that, you know, so there's a definite shift, which hasn't quite, it's like you guys are the Jetsons, you know, you're in the future, and we're over here a little bit behind.
Yeah, I don't disagree. That's been the experience that we've, I think Europe is really close.
Yeah.
I think that Latin America is probably even behind APAC.
Yes.
At least in the Australia region, right? So based on our experience. So, but yeah, so I think that, so anyway, so that was kind of what I see as the biggest failure, the biggest kind of limiter of the growth opportunity. And that being said, both regions have benefited in very real ways from the merger. So they've grown faster than they would have grown. We've grown faster than we would have grown. We've been able to kind of share some resources across. But it's been kind of very, it's been a manual and like turbulent process of we haven't systematized the global resource queue and things of those natures yet. So all stuff that now we're focused on. But one thing that I have done and it's still kind of early stage, but I have basically taken myself off of North America's books. I'm no longer focused on North America, and I'm now employed by the parent corp, which oversees the regional entities. And that is more than just a symbolic act, right? Yeah. So in reality now, I'm being held accountable to, by virtue of my compensation being come from, distributing my time, my attention, my focus more evenly across the regions that we're operating within, and also am starting to build a small core group of resources, so like marketing being one, finance being another, whose job it's going to be to have more of a global perspective. And then we can roll out. So if we're defining global kind of marketing strategy, we're defining global finance strategy, we'll then roll those out regionally, we'll implement regionally, maybe with some nuances for each of the regions based on maturity and whatnot, but starting to take more of a global view. And that coincides with, to segue into what comes next, we are opening up, it appears, I mean, it's a the dust hasn't settled yet, so I guess anything's possible. It could still go sideways, but it appears as though we're going to be opening in Dublin in end of summer here. So,
is that why you're wearing the shamrock on your t-shirt? I just
we'll call that a happy accident as well.
I love the coincidence. Is this is this Dublin acquisition or is this new? Is this new company or
we're gonna do it ourselves?
Fantastic! Yep.
So we're gonna start small.
Yep.
We're going to take some folks from the North America team, ship them over to Dublin, and have them root down, and we're committed to a couple of years with these folks. To try and establish some early traction.
Yeah.
And then we'll build out a team from there, from folks in Ireland. So as we grow, then we'll hire. Yeah.
Very similar to what HubSpot did. They sent over a core team from Boston, like maybe 12 people, and then they ballooned out, and then slowly they went and returned as it went on. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Timeline on that, Mike? Have you got a is it this year, next year?
We expected actually to be opening, I think the plan was July 1st, but when last time we came over to visit, we met with the bankers and the immigration folks, and then it kind of became evident that our timeline was a little bit unrealistic. So just logistically, the process of getting the critical skills visas and things of those natures is going to take a little bit longer than we had anticipated.
Yeah.
We're working through with the IDA to get
company
certification status, things of those natures. So
anyway,
so that whole process is kind of unfolding.
Yeah.
But we're anticipating, I think we've targeted early to mid August to have boots on the ground and doors open. So
brilliant.
So we're roughly 3 months plus or minus out.
Brilliant. Well, we'll keep a close eye on that and wish you the absolute best of luck with that. So apart from meeting people in Ireland in the next few months and years, one of the things that you said you're focusing on is this ventures. Okay, so you're coming out of the North America, you're going into the parent company, you're going to be focusing on global. but about creating a ventures division for Equity Plays. Does that mean you're actually investing in other agencies or other businesses?
Other businesses. So we did our first one back in 2009. I think we're in the process right now of going through an exit. So I think it's going to be a successful exit. It's taken, a little bit longer, 10 years of growing that business, but it was a business that we invested. It started with $0 in revenue, right? So we invested basically in an idea.
Right.
We paid the first year salary of the team to get that idea off the ground. We acquired a couple of key assets that we exchanged capital for, and in doing so took an equity position in that business, and it's grown from $0 in revenue to, I think in fiscal year 2018, it closed out with, I don't know, 30 or 35 million. Now we're in the process right now of hopefully selling it, right? And so we look at that as a great case study for what can be done. And now with kind of more resources at our disposal than we had in 2008, 2009, we don't need to invest in companies that are doing $0 in revenue and hope that they're going to grow. We can take positions in organizations that are a little bit more mature, lend our skill sets to helping grow those businesses and potentially some capital as well, especially if we do successfully consummate the sale of this original. We're going to be capitalized in a way that historically we haven't been capitalized. So, we're a $0 debt. I think I got my first credit card for the business last year, right? So we've never had a penny in debt for Salted Stone. Everything's been financed by profits generated by the business.
Putting it all back in, businesses you're really interested in? Is there markets you're interested in? Locations you're interested in? I have this vision of you doing some sort of Salted Stone Shark Tank kind of thing. how does one get it? How does one pique your interest?
that's a great question. And it's at this stage, there's not really a good answer to it. There's nothing formal. There's no formal process. There's nothing formally defined. It really is kind of like an aspiration. But we did just recently, we did take an equity position in the past 6 months in another technology company. Nice. We were a client of theirs.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And they came to us then looking for marketing assistance. Yeah. After we had been a client of theirs for about a year, they came to us looking for help. And we gave them a proposal and then it just kind of wound up. We negotiated a portion for cash, a portion for equity, and the rest is history. And hopefully that one turns out well. But so we're starting to kind of actively pursue it now. It's a light bulb that's gone on. And I think as far as the types of companies, the one thing that the company that we're selling as an example right now, the valuation process. We've gone through the valuation process. We have an investment bank involved, and right. And the valuation it's a multiple of EBITDA, right? And it's, so every company is ultimately going to be valued, it seems like, based on a multiple of EBITDA, or in some cases, as in the case of technology companies, most technology companies are not valued based on a multiple of EBITDA. They're just based on a multiple of forward earnings, of residual revenue, not even earnings, not even income.
Right.
So you take a look at a company like HubSpot as a great example. They had a $2 billion market cap before they ever turned a penny of profit. Right. How does that happen? Well, they're a technology company. They're valued different from a distribution company or a manufacturing company or a service company, especially service companies, probably the worst businesses to be into from a valuation perspective. Right. Like, hey, any agency owner listening to this podcast right now, if you have a desire to make money and exit someday and ride off into the sunset, find another industry because you're not going to do it as an agency owner.
It's a vehicle for other things. Absolutely.
So when I think about markets that we might want to get into, I look at, the only reason we'd be doing this is to scale the value of the agency beyond what the agency can possibly do organically, right? So we go to sell Salted Stone today, maybe we get a 4 to 6 times EBITDA, but we're like every other agency out there, which means our margins are thin and our EBITDA sucks. And right, it's just like, well, I'm not going to sell for that. Maybe I'll buy an RV and,
right.
But I want to be able to put gas in it.
Right? Yeah. Totally reliant on the people as well. You know, it's all about you. The people walk out the door. It's a very people intense business. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elevator assets. That's the way that's been described. They get on the elevator, they leave every day.
That's it.
Yeah. So, so I think, you know, when we look at opportunities for investment, we're looking at companies that, that can have a successful exit where they have a strong valuation, just kind of strong multiples, whether that's a tech company, that's going to be valued based on forward, you know, 7x forward revenue, you know, accrual revenue, or whether that's right. A distribution company that might get 10 to 12 times, EBITDA. What we want to shy away from is the 1x revenue or the 2 to 4x EBITDA type models. Yeah.
Got it. Very interesting. Cause yeah, we've an awful lot of skills have built up over the years through digital marketing, through inbound marketing, even just through the transition of the tools that we've used in our lives, Slack, Zoom, podcasting, recording, videos, they're all skills that people in a business haven't even started trialing yet. So with a bit of cash and your advisor on a board level or whatever, that is another vehicle for a few hours a week, you know, to put the cash in and to actually go, well, you know what, why aren't you doing all this direction? You could do your own digital transformation for a business that's investing. I think that's a very good tip for agents.
You figure, we have a lot of clients, and we're not alone in this, right? We're probably not even the most successful at this in the HubSpot ecosystem, but you have clients coming, paying anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 a month for services, right? What are they hoping that you're going to accomplish for those $10,000 to $30,000 a month in services? Well, they want you to grow their business. Well, what if instead of taking the $10,000 a month or the $30,000 a month in services, you say, you know what? We'll take 15 of that 30 in cash, but the other 15, we're going to invest. And $15,000 over 12 months is $180,000. We're going to invest $180,000 of services. What's your company valued at? Oh, it's a $10 million valuation. Great. We want 1.8% of the business in exchange for our investment.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking. So, for those agencies going, okay, past a few years and you've actually got that equity and the time to invest in it, a great way to think about it. I really like that. So they're for the ones that have a bit of skin in the game. One part of this agency life as well, like you know, I've just seen you there, Mike, you're looking buzzing, healthy, vibrant. You certainly don't look like a man who's been in the industry for 10 years. And I asked you about one of your personal habits, and I'd love you to tell us a bit more of that and about how you manage your life. But obviously with this move to Lake Tahoe, you're going to be able to continue your daily mass. You said that something that you love to do as a personal habit is your daily mass. Tell us a bit more. Have you got that in Lake Tahoe?
Yeah, actually, I went this morning right before before we jumped on this call. Yeah. I make sure that I carve out about an hour at the beginning of every day, hour and 15, before the day starts. And I either head over to the chapel, head over to a church, and make sure to spend some time in prayer and in recollection. You know, I'm a firm believer that we agency owners, but everybody, we as people, we as humans, can really control almost nothing, and we can influence very little. So we can influence a little bit more than nothing, but we can actually control nothing. There are thousands, tens of thousands, millions, maybe, I don't even know, my brain explodes when I try to think about it, of variables that influence the difference between success or failure,
right?
And I long ago gave up and just kind of like realized, and at that moment there was a tremendous kind of sense of peace that emerged from that realization, kind of like gave up owning success, like it somehow depended exclusively on me and my efforts, and I had to wake up early, be the first person at the office, work as hard as I could all day long, be the last person to go, make sure I was online all night long, right? Like I realized at some stage that that's not that's not what ultimately at the end of the day is going to determine success or failure.
No.
So anyways, I've found that hour a day, hour and a half in the morning, kind of before I get started, of recollection, of prayer, of trying to kind of put myself and frame my understanding of myself as a creature, a child of a creator, and I would argue a creator that actually cares about me, cares about me kind of as a child. That focusing on maintaining that disposition, a kind of childlike disposition. I have three kids.
Yeah,
they depend on me for everything. Right, they come to me. They're like, "Dad, I'm hungry." They go, "Dad, I'm thirsty." "Dad, I want to go outside. Dad, I need you to wipe my bum," right? Like, they depend on me for everything in their lives. And that's really kind of helped me focus my own perspective on what it might mean to maintain a childlike disposition before a creator that actually cares about me, right? Yeah. So rather than, like, my kids don't say to themselves, they don't wake up and say, "You know what? I need to figure out how to feed myself breakfast.
No.
I need to get up and I need to go and I need to get the cereal bowl and I need to get the cereal and I need to get the milk and I need to make myself breakfast. Like, it's all up to me. And if I don't make breakfast, I'm not going to eat." They don't think like that.
No, they don't. Not yet.
They say, "Dad, I need breakfast."
Give me.
And I may ask them, I may say, "You know what, Sophia, you know what, Noelle, you know what, Jeremiah, like, go and get the cereal. Bring me the cereal box."
Mm.
Right? I may, as they get older, I expect more of them.
Yeah.
And I ask them to contribute to the creation, the fixing of their breakfast.
Right.
But ultimately, it's not the whether or not they eat is not dependent upon them.
Yeah.
Right? It's dependent upon me.
Yeah.
And so I look at the business, life more broadly than the business, but certainly also the business in very much the same way. So that hour in the morning, that daily mass is I think paramount to it's at the core of the identity of me.
Yep.
And by virtue of that, even though, I mean, Salted Stone is certainly not a religiously affiliated organization by any stretch of the imagination. And we have a very, very diverse set of team members that canvas a wide spectrum of ideological beliefs and lifestyles, everything.
Yeah.
I'm still at the head of the organization.
Yeah.
And by virtue of that, I think the fact that the daily mass, the reception of the sacrament of the Eucharist is kind of at the center of me, that kind of does affect to some degree or another the rest of the organization in a way that I would hope could be described as positive.
Absolutely. I mean, you're taking care of yourself, you know, and this is a common theme that we're experiencing. We've all been there where we've grinded and hustled and been the first in the office and actually felt that we had to do it because, well, number one, we didn't have culture in place in our agencies to allow us to step back. So number one, you've got a team that supports you, but you also know that you can take an hour. You don't have to be there checking the clock. You don't have to be on top of them. You have a team that supports itself, but also a team because they know that you're going to invest in yourself. You're a better person. It is actually cyclical and it does come down a lot to culture because you put that in place. You taking the hour out, it's like a symbiotic relationship. And, you know, we've all been through those, you know, working the 18-hour days and posting about it on social media like we're actual, you know, saving the world or something ridiculous. But I can definitely see a shift. And, like, I can see it in you and I'm watching, you know, I've been around with you guys a long time and I can see the difference in the guys and the girls who are going, "Do you know what, a second now, let me take a step back here and let me invest in myself. What do I need energetically, spiritually, for my family, for my health, for my fitness, for my mind?" And the, you know, the grinders and that, you know, as you're earlier on, you do it, but you step back and you go, "Hang on, I'm in my 40s or whatever age you are," and you go, "I better, like, measure this." And
I think, at the end of the day, work is supposed to be at the service of the individual, or you know, in my case, work is at the service of my family.
Yeah.
And not the other way around, right? My family should not be at the service of my work. I should not be at the service of my job.
Yeah.
The job is something that I do to provide for the family, to provide a lifestyle.
Exactly.
It's not the lifestyle.
It's part of it. So today we'll take a little wrap up. We've been here. We've been talking all day, and I want to know what's the name on your t-shirt? What's this? What is that?
Smitty's. It's a pub in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is where my wife is from. So.
Oh, far. Yeah. Go girl. I love it. All I could see was, is that a shamrock? And it's reflective. And I was like, oh, it's an Irish bar. That's for sure. But Mike, there's somebody starting out right now. So let's say there's somebody, you know, HubSpot's still selling licenses to agency owners, and they're still getting people into the partner program. Some of the advice that you'd give somebody starting out right now, and we'll end on those notes with you.
Geez, what would I say? I think, so this may sound foolish to a lot of folks, but I would argue, so Salted Stone, from its first day, from the first dollar that we made as a business, we gave 10% of everything away. I looked at that as kind of a down payment on our success. Mm. The argument being, and again, this goes back to my own personal belief in the importance of a childlike disposition.
Yeah.
My like almost as though I was saying, you know what, like now I'm giving away to good causes, right? To help people who are less fortunate. I'm giving away a share of what you have given me. Yeah. So now it's like, you don't want my family to starve, so now you kind of got to give me a little bit more.
Yeah.
Right.
Let me do more of this. You want to do, you start, it's like you started a trickle going, okay, I'm going to start this. Let me do more of this. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, there's probably all sorts of practical advice that would be more valuable than like the philosophical advice. But ultimately what I would say, like, hey, be overly generous,
yep,
in a way that demands the creator, whatever it is that you would call that, right? Like, yep. I'm going to call it God, right? Yep. But that demands that God be equally or overly generous with you.
Yeah. Right? It's like that energy, isn't it? The energy out, it creates a vortex. It's got to bring new things in, you know?
That's some people call it karma. Some people call it whatever it might be, right?
Exactly.
Whatever terminology you would give to it.
Yeah.
But I would argue that when I look back, and if I had to try and concretely point to one thing that Salted Stone's success could be attributed to, I don't know if I could point to anything that would be any more significant than that, yep, right? Like, you're going to show up and work hard every day,
right?
Right? Otherwise, exactly. if you're not going to show up and work hard every day, then don't even start the business.
Don't start.
Right? But just because you show up and work hard every day doesn't actually mean your business is going to grow. There's plenty of people who show up and work hard every day.
Yeah.
Plenty of people who show up and work harder than me, who work harder than any of the successful HubSpot partners, that don't experience the same results. And that's what I'm saying. Like, so much of success or failure is outside of your control.
Yeah.
So if you can influence those things that are outside of your control, one way to influence those things that are outside of your control, because presumably they're controlled by some sort of, sovereign governor, right?
Right.
If there's
right.
order, you look at bees, take bees as an example.
Yeah.
Bees are unintelligent creatures. They have no ability to exercise conceptual thought, and yet all of them behave intelligently.
Correct.
Right? You take a look at, the planets.
Yeah.
They're not even sentient. They don't even have the principle of vitality, a principle of life. So you can't even say, as distinct from bees, like bees, at least they can sense things. They have a sensory capability.
Mm-hmm. Planets, yeah.
they don't have anything at all. They're inanimate bodies. And yet all of them behave intelligently. They behave according to an intelligence.
And alone, right? That's there.
Orbiting exactly. Everything else. So
yeah.
You can assume by virtue of, if you just kind of trace that all the way back, if you have all of these unintelligent beings behaving intelligently, there must be some sort of governor that is intelligence, that has imbued all of these things that don't have intelligence in their nature with an intelligence in terms of their behavior.
Right.
So if you can influence the decisions of that governor, such that all of those variables that are outside of your control are more like, compassionately aligned in your favor. That's a risk worth taking, right? I'm wrong. Maybe there is no intelligence.
No, it definitely is. I absolutely agree. And I think you brought up something that I've just heard over and over again with you as well. And we'll end on this and we'll let people get on. I'll let you get on with your day as well. But just because it's business doesn't mean you switch off your intuition. All the agency mergers that I'm hearing right now, it has started with this intuition about, I get on with that person. I have a chemistry with them. We have crack together. We like talking together. You know, who do you gravitate towards when you're at an event? It's those people. So just because it's business, don't switch off your intuition, because I think you've done that a lot in your, what it sounds like in your business career. And, you know, it hasn't done you too bad. So thank you so much.
So far, we're okay.
So far, so good. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I can't wait to get this episode out and share it with everyone. And I'm going to look forward to seeing you soon in Dublin. And having at least a dinner and somewhere nice to relax and enjoy, because your last visit was far too fly by night by the sounds of it.
It was. I'm looking forward to it as well. So we'll meet up when we're out there. You can show me a proper Irish evening.
I think I might be getting into the habit of that. I was just doing one last week. I even drank whiskey. I think it's like the second time ever I've had a whiskey shot. It was hilarious. So I'm uncovering places as we go. So that's really good. So thank you very much, Mike. And thank you everyone for listening. You'll get us. We're all over iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify. We're broadening every week. So enjoy this episode and drop us a line if you have any guests or anything you'd like us to talk about. Thank you.